didn't get it all, but thanks for the introduction. I'm very happy to be here. Thanks for inviting. It's a pleasure. As you mentioned, I'm a researcher at the Royal College of Art at the moment, studied in Berlin. Yeah, I think so. Can you hear me? I was actually a researcher at the Royal College of Art until yesterday. I just submitted my PhD yesterday noon. That's why I feel like I haven't slept for a week, which I didn't actually. So I'm a bit improvising here, but I'm doing my best. And as we are a very small group, please feel free to ask any questions, and we can have a conversation and just we make it easy. Just for my information, are you guys architects or engineers? Engineers? Okay, I'm going to talk. So my talk is called performance, what I initially thought I would call it, but then I thought, okay, I might call it between duck and tree, and I hope it makes sense in the end. It's a bit mystic. I'm going to talk about composites in architecture, composite materials, and especially about performance, not preformance. I'm going to talk a bit about biology and about tectonics, or the idea of architectural tectonics. And I'm going to illustrate that with two of my projects. The first project is called Turm 2, which means Tower 2. And the second project is called Column. So this is probably very basic. I didn't know what audience to expect. So as you are all engineers, I feel a bit embarrassed. So composite materials. What is a composite material? It's a material composed of at least two materials which combine to give properties superior to the individual constituents. You probably know how that works. There's a reinforcement involved, and a matrix material, which accounts for the tensile forces and for the compressive forces. It usually looks like that, so you can clearly see the fibers and the matrix material. And usually, if we think of composite, we think of structures like that, or like that, like really mega composite structures, modern structures. But maybe not so much of that. So that's a very natural composite. It's teeth, or for example, here that's a shell material. And one of my favorite ones probably is wood. It's composed of just main three constituents, hemicellulose, cellulose, and lignin. And just playing with these three materials, you get a really incredibly performing composite without the whole modern engineering around it. So this also, the use of wood dates back to probably far beyond 5000 before Christ. So, but that's a really impressive example, I find. It's a Neolithic longhouse, it's called. So it's around 40 meters long and 8 meters wide. So, which really gives proof that we, as humans, always engaged in composite materials, actually. Like, it's really embedded in our culture. That's another really interesting example I find. It's from Iran. It's called a motif. And it's basically reed branches bundled to create actually a structure which is actively, like, it's a active bending structure, which I find really amazing, especially how it is articulated. So you have like a homogeneous materiality throughout the whole building, but then you have a very distinctive differentiation between the structural system and the wall elements, or like the curtain elements. Probably the first engineered composite is just a simple brick. That's where actually our engagement started, with reinforcing materials with fibers. Now, this is a quick time lapse into the 20th century. So what I find really fascinating is that we de we're dependent on like really natural and cultured materials for most of our mankind. And in this relatively short period of time, the last 100 years, we came up with synthetic materials, which you guys probably all know much better than me. But what really strikes me is that we work with materials which are derived from a laboratory. So we're not harvesting them in nature, but they're really engineered and they're entirely designed in a lab. So in the 1930s, composites really took off, and they could be mass manufactured. And this is probably one of the first examples, of a composite structure in the architectural context. It was military based. It's Buckminster Fuller, and it's kind of a radar dome. That's how it started to permeate into the architectural domain. We actually got a lot of French examples here. This is Lionel Shine, if I pronounce it right, who also used composite panels. And what you can see here is really this translation of composite materials as panels. Like it's not a transformation. It's not used as a really innovative material. It's basically a substitute for a plasterboard or a multiplex board. So it's still very humble application, I would say. I would say Charles Eames kind of nailed it. He came up with a very interesting shape, which w was really appropriate to the material. So he really f used all the material properties and all the manufacturing techniques, which made the material really special and stand out. And I don't know if anyone knows this video. I find it amazing. I hope it's playing. We have sound. So that's how one of these chairs is fabricated. And it actually has this nice chassis bit. So basically you have molds and you spray this material on the mold, and then you basically soak it with the matrix material, which will be shown quite soon. So there it is. So that was one of the first automation approaches, I think, in the domain of composite materials. So I think I can stop it here. And also, this strategy to really play with the form and shape and what the material actually has to offer permeated through into architecture, where we see this house of the future, which was a collaboration between the MIT and Monsanto, which I find also very interesting in regards to how architecture is made. So Monsanto is a very is a chemical company, and MIT is of course a research institution. So they paired up into forming a interdisciplinary venture to think about new architecture. And before that, you had wood or you had steel, and there was the steel industry. And usually, an architect wouldn't probably work directly with a steel engine with a steel manufacturer to engineer a new steel material. So this is really an interesting point in regards to collaboration. And we saw examples like that, which are amazing, and they literally took off. So this was the idea to transport them and plant them everywhere. Prefabricated houses, and I find them just very beautiful. But then the oil crisis struck, and also the manufacturing was too expensive, so it actually never really took off. So modern examples are, for example, this new Apple auditorium. That's also a completely composite roof, which is just carried by glass panels. And of course, this example, which I showed earlier on, it's probably the most popular mega structure entirely made from composites. A slightly different direction can be seen here, where the material is actually used not just to be structural or lightweight, but to be activated, to really be responsive and reactive to its environment, which I'm talking later on a bit about. But still, the manufacturing is very labor intense, and it takes ages, basically. But the aerospace industry, of course, took they contributed a lot to automation, which also then came into architecture, which are projects you might know. It's the ICD Itkip Pavilions, where we have robotic manufacturing applied in the context of architecture. This would be another example of that. And what you can see here, this on the left side is one of the Itkip Pavilions as well. And on the right side is a previously shown example. And it's really striking how different the material is used in regards to its expression. So, where you can see on the left side, it's really coming, like where the matrix material is not as apparent on the right, on the left side as on the right side. So you really have a very fine fibrous texture. But composites, however, they come with a downside, which is usually, unfortunately, their sustainability. So there's not much. So, I mean, first of all, they're usually petrochemically derived. So we have a lot of, so carbon fiber or synthetic fibers are made from oil. And they use a big amount of energy to be fabricated, which in the context of airplanes and functional structures, which are really generating energy or due to their lightweight, safe energy, it's absolutely legit, I would say. And it has been proven that they really contribute to much more efficient means of transportation. But within the context of architecture, it's quite critical because we use a lot of energy to put into the material system, but there it's not really contributing to how we can amortize this energy again. And also their disposal is a bit critical, where there are not really any recycling strategies yet. So the common form is either chemical degradation or pyrolysis, which is basically burning the matrix material to separate the fibers and the matrix, which needs for the pieces of fiber, carbon fiber, to be chopped down and to be burned, basically. That would be okay if you could use the fibers again, I guess, but they are really chopped down and they can't be used to the same standard as they were before they were chopped off. Which kind of brings me to the topic of performance. So what we saw here is, or what I just described, is the whole journey a material is undergoing through in its lifetime. It starts from sourcing, extracting, refining, production. Then we reach finally a stage where we have a product or a part, and then that should actually be disposal here on the far right. I got it right on the next slide here. So what I want to say with that is that our performative or our aesthetic frame is really focused on the product or the part itself. And That's why I came up with the name of preformance, and there might be also a post performance thing going on, where these three steps before, or like there's more steps than three, but this period before we have the actual part, the building or the product, are not that crucially important to the aesthetics or to the performance of the whole material. Also, the disposal or the life cycle doesn't really contribute to the whole aesthetic perception of a material itself or a structure. So, what I was wondering in my research, how we could actually enlarge this frame, how can we use the whole spectrum of the material and use it as an aesthetic opportunity, as really thinking about how materials behave dynamically, how they could, how a manufacturing system or a tectonic system can express all these steps. That was kind of the aim, and it's of course really tricky and almost not possible, but it's that's just being said, and now I'm going to continue to talk about biology, another anchor of my work. So, especially in the context of sustainable design and new functionality and performativity, there has been many strategies have been developing in regards to biomimetics, bio-inspired bionics, biomorphic, and all of them kind of talk about extracting knowledge or like a design strategy from an organism. And this happens to illustrate itself in things like that. Like I really picked out the most curious ones, or where this is to a level where it's might be at some point not valid anymore. I love that one. Sorry, I guess you all know the biomimetic stuff, so I really picked out like some borderline stuff here. And I really like that picture. It's quite deep. So again, what we saw here is clearly we have an organism and we extract knowledge from that in regards to its movement, its behavior. And but what we're not acknowledging so much in this field is actually the way this organism is generated. So through basically a cellular system generates this organism through biological metabolism. So, but we usually use the final organism to extract this knowledge or to extract design methodologies. And I would quickly want to explain what metabolism is. Is anyone, any biologists here? No. Okay, good. So it's understood as the chemical processes that occur within a living organism in order to maintain life. And the most basic distinction is made between two metabolic, two metabolic pathways, which is catabolic, which means breaking down compounds and releasing energy. It's when you eat, basically, or anabolic, and which means building up compounds and consuming energy. So this is actually how it. You can't see it. That's all kind of chemical formulas. That's how a metabolic, how the complexity of a metabolic pathway. These are all together, and that's the kind of the map biologists operate with to distinguish specific metabolic pathways. But I don't really want to go into that. So what's really fascinating, I think, is that a rather easy principle, so with a distinct feature of self-regeneration, a distinct input and a distinct output, a cell basically generates emergent properties which illustrate or like which appear in the form of structure, intelligence, locomotion, or sensing. And the idea here is, okay, can we actually derive some knowledge from that? Like, can we view that process as an inspiration for, or as a design driver? And of course, I'm not the first one investigating this or asking these questions. But the problem here was, at least in the last decade, or like that we are not, that the living cell was always a black box. So if we have a bird, we can easily extract knowledge from it because we see how it moves. So it's very apparent. Whereas if we look at a living cell or an organic system, we always, it was for a long time that we would assume the function of it. So we needed a kind of a framework, which came also in, which started off like, which is my departure point of, as mechanistic origin, where, for example, when we go back to Descartes, for example, that he actually viewed that all was natural, was also mechanical. And consequently, and any differences between animals and man-made artifacts were purely quantitative rather than qualitative, which is quite striking, I think. And then even going that far, that Lemaître, my pronunciation is very bad, described a human as a self-winding machine, a living representation of perpetual motion. And these mindsets or these philosophies then inspired a series of really interesting and peculiar automatons, which I investigated in my research. So that is, for example, one of these automatons where a very complex mechanical system is underlying to drive a puppet, basically, to draw something on a piece of paper. And to quickly illustrate that, I brought a movie. An automaton which writes and draws is in many ways a mystery, even centuries later. It's quite creepy, actually, but it's really fascinating how the mechanics work of it. Okay, I think you get it. So, and one of my favorite, most favorite automatons is also French. It's the duck. You probably know that, right? No. It's from Jacques Vaucanson, and he first exhibited it in 1739. And it was basically exhibited in a kind of classicistic pavilion. And on the left side, you see a mechanical drummer. On the right side, a mechanical flute player. And in the middle, there's this duck. And this duck would basically poop. So it was basically shitting on this pedestal, which is, I find it from an artistic viewpoint, very striking and interesting. So, but this duck here, this is an illustration where they really reproduced a duck by mechanical means, but this duck, the duckness of the duck was basically, the duck was reduced to its digestive system and with a very big underlying mechanical apparatus on it. But what I, so long story short, what I want to tell you with this is that usually we perceive these automatons or like these installations where they try to replicate some kind of intelligence. So the boy would draw, or the flute player would play flute. But none of these machines actually described a metabolic process. But I look at the duck and see, okay, actually the duck is describing by mechanical means a metabolic process. And I took that as a starting point to investigate, okay, how can we see this mechanical domain coming together with a energy domain? And of course, again, another time lapse, metabolism and architecture, it also permeated through into the architectural field, where we see, for example, from the 80s, the city as a living organism, which undergoes a process of renewal and obsolesis, experiencing a cyclical transformation and declines comparable to those of organic tissue. So this is a very abstract and metaphoric analogy, and it describes more in a very open and processual way how we could see metabolism in architecture. But I want to be more in go more towards the duck side of it. I'm really interested in how can we actually make a statement, an architectural or mechanical statement, and think about metabolism as a design driver for tectonics, for new tectonic expressions. So what we see here is that we have to deal with a very, if we compare nature with architecture, we compare very different principles and things, actually. We compare autopoiesis, which is basically what you call a self-regenerating system. It's constantly, it's a metabolic system, it's dissipative and dynamic, whereas architecture usually is very static, and it doesn't generate itself, so it's kind of a very static representation of a structure. And of course, also the way how the structure is generated. So a tree would generate itself by the means of its environment. So it would draw all the energy, all the resources it needs from its environment. Whereas in order to build something, we basically need, we extract things from the environment and put it somewhere else, and we consume energy doing this. So this is kind of the, yeah, overly simplified, I would say. But it just, I think, brings it on the point. So coming back to this overview I previously shown, is that we are actually perceiving architecture much like a product or part, where we have a very static expression of architecture or static idea. Also this static idea, it remains, so it's really this focus, this design, and it doesn't really change that much. The tree on the other side is behaving completely different. So it's one static system which incorporates all of that in a very humble and elegant way, I think. And thinking about it, it's a really rich role model and a potential inspiration for architecture as well. So I thought, okay, how can we actually translate this into a tectonic system? And if we look at conventional manufacturing, we always have a very differentiated view of the processes, I would say. Like, we have a construction period, and we reach through this construction, we reach a tectonic expression. So tectonic is actually not processual, so it's static. Whereas through an autopoietic system like a tree, it's on the constant change and in its environment. Which also brings me to these very advanced and high-tech structures, which are very complicated, but still they don't, this distinction between human machine material and tectonics is still very much separated. So the question I was asking myself was, can the process of construction be an integral part of the tectonic expression? And can the tectonic expression shift from static to dynamic? So pretty much, again, the tree analogy. And now to the fun part, the project. I would like to present you two of my projects. So which both work with matrices, like active matrices, and both work with continuous texture manufacturing processes. I'm presenting two projects. This is the first one where I'm investigating a winding process, a composite winding process, and through, and I would say it can be understood as a material computation, and a secondary a demonstrator, which is using biological systems to build up a substructure, and it works with knitting. I think I have to hurry a bit. So the basic concept was using materials, natural materials, which were generated through this process of regeneration, and then extracting from them a raw material, which gets incorporated into a manufacturing process, which is at the same time driven by sunlight. So the construction process would be in accordance to the sun intensity. And also at the same time, I'm using a UV hardening linseed oil resin, which reacts to sunlight as well. So there would be a correlation between the construction time, the construction intensity, and the environment. And at the same time, the whole structure is biodegradable and can potentially feed back into this system. So this is how the machine looked in the beginning. And I'm already thinking, for me, this is a machine, but at the same time, it's integral part of the tectonic expression. So I'm not differentiating between structure and machine. For me, that is one piece, one organism, so to say. It's actually quite easy how it works in principle. It starts with a circular movement, which is translated into a vertical movement. And due to that turning and this vertical up and down, an impregnated yarn is wrapped around the main structure. And in a second step, the whole thing is driven upwards. So a structure emerges from the machine, so to say. And the composite materials are layered in these clamps, which are made from silicon, so they can kind of hold the fibers, but they can also release it so it doesn't really stick on them. These are some details for you engineering guys, probably quite not very advanced, but it's rather simple, like circular movement, and here it's kind of getting translated into a vertical movement. This is the printhead. Here on the lower part is this UV hardening resin. Here's the material, and here's some more resin in, and this thing would twist around. Okay, I brought a movie as well, so we see the whole thing in action. So what you can see here is the material deposited on the structure, and this is already in its hardened state. So the light was curing the composite system, so it's already hard. And during the manufacturing, during the winding, it's still soft. So how it works is basically it starts with a basic zigzag. So these are the individual nodes, and then gradually they get overlaid. They have to be seven because it then always steps one step further. So in the end, we have a full pattern, which then enters this cycle. So always another pattern is added from the bottom, and it kind of starts again. So we always add material from the bottom to the top. This is a detail how it looks, and this is the material, the full structure, fully developed through this process. I'm going to show a quick movie how the whole thing worked. It's actually not a quick movie. I don't know how much time we still have, but are we good in time? Yeah. So the idea, and I think you can see it's not about fast manufacturing. It's really about a process which took actually in real time 3 weeks. So the machine was working continuously for 3 weeks, wrapping the material around the structure and then driving it upwards. So here the fibers are running into this bath of resin and getting applied through this print head. And simultaneously there would be horizontal connections. So this is the upward mechanism. So it would stop for a second or for a couple of minutes, and then slowly the whole thing, the whole structure would be driven upwards. And on the so these clamps, they just go all the way around, and then in a new clamp would emerge from the bottom and would be a new point where the structure can be attached to. So it was quite an adventure to engineer the thing to get it working, because it was basically the tolerances were a nightmare. Okay, I think. Can maybe put it a bit further. So yeah, that's how it worked for basically 2 weeks. Okay, not again. And with this project, I also developed a speculative implication, which took place at the Aral Sea, which is a very specific area where it used to be the world's fourth largest lake in the world. So with a complete area of 66,000 square kilometers, and through really extensive agriculture, basically the cotton industry, the whole lake dried out, and the seawater level sunk by 19 meters, so the whole riverbed is exposed, and they have massive problems because of they used a lot of fertilizers, so the whole area is contaminated and super dry and super windy. So my implication area was a fisherman's village, which is here, basically, which used to be a fisherman's village. Now the lake is here. And they don't have any access to actually to the lake, which is a bit very sad. And it turned out that they got very big problems with the wind coming in. and carrying this dry sand, and the sand is contaminated. So there was the idea of creating a wind barrier and also to kind of remediate the landscape. So the idea was to develop these towers, which would self-unfold, and they would actually use, because all the resources they have is basically cotton. The cotton industry is still active there, and they also produce a lot of linseed oil. So I thought, okay, that might be an occasion to really use the material, which are very local. And of course, this is a very speculative application here, but the idea is really to have this connection with the environment, with the local products, to generate a new kind of a growth vegetation of which would then in the end transform the whole landscape. These are two renderings we did. Okay, so in the end, we use materials which are directly derived from the land where the machine is based on. And through this structure, it would rise and then give kind of birth to a new generation of vegetation. So it's kind of the idea was to create an autonomous assembly, which then generates itself like a mini ecosystem. Of course, this is very speculative here. So the second project I would like to show you is it's called Column. It's a collaboration between myself and Daniel Suarez, who is also a researcher in our program. He's based in Berlin at the UDK, and we got support from Soletage Bachy and Eurocat with this project. So whereas with the last project I showed, we used a biological analogy, so it's basically not a real organism or not real biology. With this project, we really try to use the biological metabolism in itself, so not an abstraction or an analogy, which is this part down here, the second demonstrator, and for this we used knitting. So I looked into biofabricated or bioderived materials where you have kind of mushroom bricks. I think everyone of you knows that. Or you use bacteria to generate nanocellulose sheets, basically, which can then be used for very sustainable fashion or cloth. So these two systems generate microstructures through biological metabolism. So for my application, it was really interesting to look into that. But at the same time, what they mainly do, or a lot of these projects are, they use either surfaces or they use volumetric approaches. So my idea was to really look into how can we use this in a more spatial context. And I was quite inspired by Saraceno's work or a friend, Sandbach, on the right side, where textiles actually offer a complete different quality. In contrast to a volumetric system or a planar system. So this is much more complex and offers more geometrical possibilities. At the same time, we thought knitting would be an amazing technology to use because it offers such a high versatility in regards to customization. So you can implement channels. You can implement different structures within one piece. This all would come out like finished out of the machine. So basically, we thought about wouldn't it be great to have like a matrix which is really metabolizing, like actively biologically metabolizing? And we thought about okay, that there must be a way to actually implement a microorganism on a fiber, like to treat it in a way that it's starting to grow by itself, basically, to establish a microstructure between the fibers in order to generate a structure. So I did a very initial test where I just put any fiber, really random into a petri dish, and you can see how many, like what a myriad of different organisms completely colonize this tiny bit of fabric or like tiny bit of yarn. So we thought, okay, this could be actually used to not just use it at very random as it's here, but can we actually control this property? And can we use a yarn, or can we develop a treatment process where we have a very homogeneous culture where just one culture develops on a yarn? This brought us to the idea of actually designing a textile microbiome. So the textile microbiome is a field of which is studied in fashion design, or like in technical textiles mostly, which is concerned basically that like people start to smell because of a textile microbiome, for example. So you have certain bacteria on your body, and then they get also like your body is in constant exchange with the textiles you wear. So some of these cultures get automatically transposed to textiles you wear. So this is a field of research where people look into clothing or like fibers, which are most as so what they want to achieve is more is not to colonize the fibers, but to make them most antiseptic. So actually to avoid the development of any smell. So we thought, okay, if there's a science which tries to avoid this, so why can't we just go and say, okay, it's working, it's there. These fibers have the ability to carry microorganisms. Why can't we just use it for our purposes? And especially natural fibers, what we can see here in a very scanning electron microscopy, have these kind of channels. They're called lumens, and a very rough and very large surface area, which makes quite perfect conditions actually for microorganisms to strive. So they would settle on this rough surface, and they would just feel fine there. They really like it. So what I focused on was one bacterium out of the Pasteur group, which you usually find in, for example, marine structures where. Which is called biocalcification. So this bacterium would not actually grow, but it will trigger a biochemical reaction, which then deposits calcite like layer by layer, and over hundreds of years, such structures would emerge. So this technology has also been recently explored by couple of companies for underground solidification. So basically what they would do is inject it into the ground, and then this bacteria would trigger this biochemical reaction which would bind like tiny sand grains together, what you can see here on the right side. So through this bacterial process, we generate like a solid structure. So we tried it on textiles and fibers, and it turned out that it actually works really good. So what we can see here are the tiny fibers which we treated with the bacteria, and they develop these structures, and therefore they gain stability. And so in a way, this is our matrix material. And also over the different periods of treatment. So we have, for example, this is two cycles, and this would be five cycles. So we could actually achieve a gradient, a material gradient through the bacterial treatment. We did a couple of initial material tests, like compressive and tensile tests. And they, yeah, I mean, we didn't have that much samples, so it's not a very complete test, but it gave us enough confidence to say that we could actually realize a taller structure. The last project was dealing with winding, and this project is dealing with knitting, which is actually a very interesting technology if you look at it from a geometric viewpoint, because you have one material, and through manipulation, you can change its behavior, its structure, but you don't change the material itself. So it has a kind of a constant topology, but it can vary its geometry. And on the other side, you have a very distinctive hierarchy. So you have the fiber level, a yarn level, and a structural level. And we were interested in very simple forms of knitting. What you can see on the left side, it's a very easy toy to knit. And you have probably seen that at your grandma's place. It's super easy to knit with it, but it also, at the same time, provides a lot of variability. So the way you knit it, like the way you operate it, the way you can control the structure. So every move, basically what you do with your hand, is influencing, in the end, this structure on the right side. So you can really determine with distinctive patterns how you want the structure to behave and how you want it to look. And this material is just going through. It's one material, but just through different manipulation strategies, you achieve a different structure. So this is a very basic simulation we did. And the idea was, okay, we thought, okay, what could it be? And we came up with the idea of doing a column, a very basic and fundamental architectural element. And we thought, okay, with this column as a proof of concept, we can try out many different scenarios without being too complex in the global geometry. But at the same time, we want to react to these forces which occur quite logically on the bottom. We have stronger compressive forces. So we thought, okay, can we actually introduce a material gradient which is locating more material on the bottom and then gets thinner to the top. So we try to apply, okay, this is the column analogy, like this is quite, you get it, I guess. And yeah, again, so we try to apply two strategies. So the first strategy was we wanted to produce one continuous material, which means 500 meters about, of yarn, where we would knit this in one go. We wanted this material to be thicker in the beginning and thinner in the end, so which would influence the material deposition, of course, because you would start knitting on the bottom with a thick material, and then it's getting gradually thinner and thinner. So this would be the first strategy we wanted to apply. And the second strategy we wanted to apply is changing the pattern itself. So we have, on the one side, the yarn is changing in diameter, and on the other side, the pattern itself is changing. So geometry and material. And through this, we were able to actually save 28% of material. And this is how we this is the yarn architecture, I would say. So this is 150 meters and it has this cross section. And then you can see it thinning out towards the bottom, at the top. Then production. Our aim was to do it really quick. And of course it took weeks to get it right. Where we had like the infill material and one material which is wrapping a sleeve around, so basically fabricating it in one go. And this is how the setup looked. We had this kind of fill material and it goes up and then it gets manufactured here. So every time we would introduce a gradient, we could just cut a yarn and make the material automatically thinner. So we kind of streamlined this production process. At the beginning, we were super ambitious and we wanted to stuff fibers and do everything, but this was very pragmatic towards the end, but in the end, the best solution. And what you can see here is kind of a color code. We introduced a color code to have a thicker yarn, so you can see it here. And this is one continuous, it doesn't really appear, but it's one continuous material. But then we were left with the question, where's our loom actually? How do we operate this yarn? And also we had to think about this gadget or this kind of machine. We came up with a different machine appropriate to the specific use case. And then we also thought, I mean, it was always this kind of chicken egg situation. If we do a yarn, we have to have a loom. And if we have a loom, we have to do a special yarn. And this kind of triggered this process of thinking, okay, why don't we just wrap it all together in one installation, which can serve for everything? So the heart of the project is basically this structure, which can take the loom, which is saw here. And at the same time, it can be exchanged to a bioreactor. So the base structure is rather simple plywood engineering here. And what you can see here is the first setup with the loom. It's here. So the tricky bit was that we had a yarn, a material which wasn't stretchable at all. So usually, when you knit, stretchability is very important because you want to make these loops working. But in this case, we couldn't really accommodate any flexibility or elasticity in the yarn. So we actually had to react with the geometry of these packs. They're called packs, which means you could wrap a yarn around here, and then you would have to do the loop, and this indent would give you a bit more play. So it's kind of quite elaborate geometry we came up here, which in the end solved a really simple problem. It's all a bit over-engineered. Okay, this is another thing. Then knitting again is at the same time simple, but at the same time super complex, and we were able to simplify the whole process slightly. We had to have a level of abstraction, so we couldn't simulate the whole knitting system. So we had to basically extract general rule sets, and we found out that actually a non-tensed knitted system is more or less an orthogonal grid, and as soon as you tense it, it starts to become a diagonal grid, which is very good, of course, in terms of cross bracing. If you want to make a tower or a column, you need some cross bracing. So it would basically look like that, where you have one column and then you would stretch it. And of course, this would be very slender here and here. What we did was doing like we put some metal inlays in here, like rings. This is also a technique we taught us ourselves, so we didn't have any grandma telling us, but we really had to try that over and over again, but it really worked. And this is kind of our process. Does it play? Yes. So this is kind of the basic parameters was the height of the machine, how much material we can actually accommodate. Then we simulated this loopings with the loom, and there's some relaxation involved. Then we needed to, of course, re-topologize the whole thing, and that's for me the really interesting part where you then through this tensing reach a diagrid structure. Okay, this is the knitting process here. That's what I wanted to show you. I'm showing this video later again with another bit so you can see everything. So we had an approach where we tried to do where we tried to make a robot doing this, but which was really pointless. Like we ran into so many issues. So it's a very complex thing. You have to remember every pattern and everything you do. Basically, it follows a very distinct rule set. What you do is, and if you miss one loop, like you basically fuck up the whole structure. So it could just fall apart if you miss one bit to kind of interlock with the other. So you end up with a hole, and this hole would just like expand and take apart the whole structure. So this picture shows the differentiation of the geometries. So we have the thick yarn in the bottom, but we also have a different structure in the bottom. So we have a thick yarn and a structure we investigated, which makes the whole thing much thicker. And then towards the top, we get lighter and lighter, and on the top, we really were gambling a bit and went to the lightest thing we can actually. We just saw this part. I wanted to tell you a bit about that part. Of course, we had to come up with a bioreactor, and it was all a bit on the go and a bit slightly chaotic, but what we had was this. But it, of course, it's not the scale and nothing. It's just basically a principle we, or like I worked on, which works basically if you think of a car wash and a kebab, you kind of almost there, like it's more or less like a sprinkler system. And through a constant rotation and a distinctive speed, you generate this bacterial activation, basically. And the challenge of that was to scale this up. And because we wanted to put a column in here, which was 1.60 meters. So we had to get back to the drawing board. You don't really see that. It's also just showing off my CAD skills. No, that's the important bit. So that's the bioreactor, which also plugs into the system where there was the loom before that. And now we can see this space and also a very different irrigation system to the previous example I showed. So in the second step, we mounted the knitted structure in there. This is a detail where you can see how where we have like one internal irrigation system and one external irrigation system. That's also why we had this distinctive shape. It emerged out of the function, basically, and where we can plug in the pump. These are some more details. A bit obsessed with details. Yeah, this is how the treatment works. And it alludes again a bit to what I was previously mentioning, this black box effect, where you don't really actually know what's going on. You have a certain installation or a certain materiality that it kind of in a way expresses what happens, but you can't see it. You can't you can't really perceive it, so you end up with very, very cryptic process in the end. So it's more like if you think of a person who's brewing beer or making cheese. It's also like a bit this kind of course it's not magic, but you just stand in front of this thing and you actually don't really know what's going on, but there's something going on. This is the irrigation. So this process took around 3 days, where we repeated this treatment around 8 times. Okay, so and after the whole thing dried off, we reached, so this was before and this is after, and the structure, we had a support system in there, like which was tensing the whole textile, and then we treated it while being tensed. And then we took this substructure out and ended up with a freestanding, really rigid column. Actually, it's almost on the bottom, at least, really hard as concrete. Of course, we did some sciencey stuff. We also this company which supported me was so friendly to convince another university to make these pictures, like these magnifications, where you can clearly see the deposition which happened on a fiber level, where you have the fiber and then this interface and basically the bacteria which deposited the calcite on fiber level. So coming back to this guy, so of course we didn't reach a tree, but that was never the ambition of it. But it was in a way also to extract some knowledge or some design parameters to think about how a tree works in on a material, on a processual or performative level, where you also have a material gradient on a micro scale and a macro scale, which is reacting to external parameters through. And this is all generated by a self-regenerating organism, basically. And if we now put this against it, of course, it feels a bit clumsy. But at the same time, we did achieve some microstructural changes. At the same time, we have a variance in fibers, like we have a deposition which is clearly reacting to external parameters, and we have also this bacterial part where we actively employ biological metabolism to in order to generate a structure. And on a macro scale, we also have a geometry which is reacting according to load cases. So thank you very much.